All right, so we just finished watching the video from Richard Arrowsmith. You can find it at blackdogstar.blogspot.com, May 2011. The video is called Dark Night of the Soul. I just
Soul
wanted.
spelled SOL and night as KNIH.
Where did I read that Saturn was once recognized as SOL, Sol? Have you ever heard that?
I don't know. I thought it was just the sun.
No, I read somewhere that, God, I wish I knew where I read this, that for a long time Saturn was associated with Sol as the center of, and I think you would address a certain parts of this with the rearrangement of the Tree of Life, where the positions of Saturn and the Sun were switched
Well,
out.
Saturn was actually Malkuth, which is Earth. So, but then, yeah, actually, the sun, I believe, is Gevorah, which is now taken as Mars. So, but, and then Mercury was Tiferet, which is now the sun. But, yeah.
If there are theories that take a sort of that Saturn is like electric models of the universe, things like that. There are a lot of people who are taking this idea that Saturn was once incredibly close to the Earth, and that people were able to see Saturn looming over the sky. There's a whole theory like that. This is why the idea that Saturn is sort of the originator god in all the Greco-Roman stories. But you come up into that as you wish. But I never heard that it was Sol. That's interesting. But it was definitely the father figure of all the other planets and stuff like that. Did
So,
anyone else find it interesting that there was all this correlation between 42 and T in this video, that you were talking about the Douglas Adams dark
yeah,
T
Dark Night
time of
of
the soul?
the yeah, totally. So, okay, Miriam and April are the two older women in this, and I find like in Coraline. So I find it interesting that the word Miriam actually literally means star of the sea, right? Which is so you have like Mary, right? Which is the sea, but then like Rosemary is foam of the sea, which I thought was funny because Mia Farrow in The Last Unicorn, the foam of the sea is literally the unicorns trapped in the sea by the Red Bull, which seems to, I don't know, it's like some fucked up Taurus kind of thing. But anyways, I was finding it interesting that the star, the way that she is presented in the theater scene in the movie when they do this whole presentation,
She's Venus, yeah.
she is Venus, and like the classic Venus painting, which I actually am looking at right now on my wall. She is in the, I guess, is it a clam? Is it an oyster? I don't know. Where are pearls found? But I was just thinking of Mother of Pearl, the pearls that fall in Batman at the Monarch Theater right after the character supposed to be Jack Nicholson says, "Have you ever danced with the devil in the pale moonlight?" And then all the pearls drop. And so I don't know. I was thinking pearl, and then I'm like, "What? Why was I just thinking of pearls recently?" And I think that there was another case, but this one is kind of interesting, is Miriam of Star of the Sea, which also brings me my mind to Titanic with the heart of the sea, which she drops into the ocean, the woman who's supposed to be Kate Winslet older, right?
Which, of course, is a big blue stone, like a sapphire. And sapphire, I've connected to all this stuff many times over.
Right. So spherot means sapphire. So you have Yesod, which is the sapphire pavement. Which is the foundation of the tree above Malkuth, and so to call that the heart is very interesting.
One nice little nugget was, last night I had a particular conversation. Someone at the bar said that they could do a really good elephant impersonation. So, insert your own elephant noise there. And she was looking for new animals to impersonate. And I just immediately said, "Well, how about a giraffe?" And she says, "What?" She said, "What do giraffes sound like?" I go, "I have no fucking clue." So that was a nice little pop up to see the giraffe in there. I don't know necessarily. I guess they were connecting it to the giraffe of Toys R Us with the blue star of Sirius next to him.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just saw the R in the red in the blue circle that was on Jeffrey's shirt there, and I immediately thought of Robin with the R in the red circle in his costume. So you had your twin stars there. You have
the dynamic duo.
Yeah.
Yeah, the twin stars of Sirius are the dynamic duo.
Or you have these twin shadows of Batman. You have the child he was never allowed to be because of the trauma that he experienced at such a young age, that his childhood is split into two kind of imaginary persona.
That's interesting because that would be why a lot of his villains are sort of these childhood comical figures, particularly the Joker, the idea, I was thinking of him as the man with all the toys, sort of like, your Santa Claus. When I was looking at the video, he shows Toys R Us as Toy Sirius, but he just wiped Toy off the screen. But if you did Toy Sirius, the Joker is the man with all the toys.
Well, all those villains of Batman are very childlike dream imagery villains. That if you really think that that's who the bad guys are, and it's just a very childlike outlook on what's wrong with the world. And really, Batman and specifically the Joker in The Dark Knight, which is when the Dark Knight theme really becomes the centerpiece to Christopher Nolan's take on all this, is that Batman was created when he was a child, when the protectors failed in their ability to protect his protectors, and that the police were incapable of saving his parents from being killed. So that's where the genesis of the Batman begins.
Yeah,
and the Joker is created because he never had any protector at all. He could give a shit about police because the people he was born into this world, his protectors, he didn't suffer trauma because his protectors were killed. He suffered trauma because his protectors were abusers, right? So the Joker is born in childhood when, what's his story in that? That he was, I don't know the specifics of it, but who cuts his face open like that? Was it his father?
Oh, but
if I remember rightly, the story changes throughout the he tells.
It changes throughout.
Yeah.
But for me, the dominant nightmare that we're born into in the 20th century affects us into our childhood, is that the cloak of childhood is ripped off in one of two ways. God is dead. Your parents bring you into a world with a God as being established, and if you're smart enough to get to Nietzsche and the whole God is dead thing and to experience that, well, you're thrown into a dark night. That's a very terrifying component of your psyche to be removed. And it's usually removed in a very traumatic or very explosive or very it's a sharp pain. It doesn't erode over time. I think maybe for simple people, the concept of God is dead erodes over decades till they become an agnostic and they think, fuck, we're all religions, we're all bullshit.
Well,
that's a very safe way to have that transformation. I don't think you ever have a dark night of the soul. You might have a dull tea time of the soul. It's not horrifying.
The meaning of the dark night of the soul is the same as melancholia. So we're looking at the film Melancholia, but then the etching, the famous etching of Melancholia, is about the philosopher's state, which is the same. They're saying the same exact thing. I mean, they parallel completely. And so I thought that was interesting, too.
I agree with that completely. But for the Joker, this whole concept that you could be born even into the possibly the richest country in the world, the country that everyone else on the globe that we're led to believe looks up to, that you could be born in America to parents who would abuse you, right? You don't even have a fucking chance. There's no police officers to protect you in the home. So the idea that, I mean, that's as horrifying a concept as it could be, in that no one can really, or it, the dark night is when you figure out where you come to grips with the notion that an innocent child can be born into the world and be born into a house of horrors, right? That you are as vulnerable as you'll ever be, and in that moment of vulnerability, you wake up into a situation where those that are supposed to love you are abusing you. And
well, who is Heath Ledger as the Joker? Who would his father be? Jack Torrance, no?
Okay.
Right, you know what I'm saying?
No, absolutely. So what I would say is that, it's striking right to the core of all that. Danny, his parents, his protectors are zombies. I mean, he's with the living dead. To say that he has a mother and a father that's in title only. That's not a mother and that's not a father. Those are two of the walking dead who have absolutely no idea what they're doing, and they have absolutely no ability to take care of a child. Christ, the Joker is Danny's father.
I'm thinking of Danny Torrance, who's his father's of obviously Jack Nicholson, the first Joker. When he has all those strangulation marks on him, uh-huh. Well, now you have Heath Ledger as the Hanged Man Joker, and then as we saw in this video, all the Christian Bale hanging imagery. So, of course, these, where did you get those marks on your neck type deal, I think is totally really interesting.
So, okay. There's this whole thing, obviously, with The Shining, with John Lennon. Wendy's reading Catcher in the Rye. It's named after Instant Karma, etc. But I think it's interesting that there's this whole take on the fact that you have December 8th is when the U.S. declares war in the 40s, right? After Pearl Harbor, right? So you have this whole thing where Mark David Chapman is born and raised in Hawaii. He has this whole Hawaiian connection, right? And then Yoko Ono, who's the other person on the scene besides John Lennon, is from Japan, bringing Japan to America, this whole thing. And so in a way, you have a collision of Japan and Hawaii on December 8th, the same day that we declare war after Pearl Harbor. And then in The Shining, you have the Monarch poster next to the two twins, right? And then Monarch Theater in the original Batman, the mother drops her pearls after You Ever Dance with the Devil in the Pale Moonlight. Maybe symbolically suggesting Pearl Harbor. I don't know. Just some brainstorming.
Okay, let me run with that. So Pearl Harbor, of course, the response to that is the atomic bombings of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, right?
Right.
So we have our whole... we know that the first detonation of the atomic bomb is July 16th, right? That's the Trinity test. If you follow my reasoning, is that the sort of response to Pearl Harbor is the Trinity bomb in that respect, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Wait. Pearl Harbor happens way before any atomic.
Right, but he's saying in the long run, you're beginning something and you're ending something.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
So Pearl Harbor, quote unquote, starts it. And the atomic bomb, quote unquote, ends it. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And one of the things that I'll keep coming back to is that the bomb in Nagasaki was actually the third bomb, making it the true Trinity. They call the first bomb test Trinity, but it's actually Nagasaki was the third one, so that makes it the true Trinity. Anyway, Trinity takes place July 16th. Same day as the moon launch, same day as Catcher in the Rye is published. So what's really interesting is that going with that sort of Jay Widener, you know, moon landing encoded in The Shining, if the movie starts with Wendy reading The Catcher in the Rye, there's your July 16th reference.
Okay.
Right? Apollo 11, which we see Danny on Danny's shirt, launches on July 16th and lands on July 20th on the moon. It takes 4 days. What is the poster at the end? Is the July 4th ball. So you see the 4 days in July would be July 16th to July 20th. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Yes.
So that there's more, but just sort of that's where my mind went is the fact that this sort of Catcher in the Rye reference at the beginning, and later Kubrick ends up releasing Eyes Wide Shut on July 16th. Well, actually, I guess he was dead, so he didn't. But you know what I mean. Eyes Wide Shut also comes out in theaters on July 16th.
Right, so you were saying The Catcher and the Rye is Wide Shut.
Correct, yeah.
Okay, so who do you guys remember who Lucy Dent is? It came to my mind in connection to Batman, and I couldn't remember, and I looked it up, and I see was the wife of Harry Dent, mother of Harvey Dent. They're killed in a car accident, leaving their son Harvey an orphan. I'm trying to remember what this is in Batman, because it's just interesting, because I'm thinking... the whole thing with Lucy as a code for LSD, and we're talking here about how there's this connection between splitting the atom and LSD, grand synchronicity with the Moonchild, so that LSD being the Moonchild. And so I was considering who the fuck Lucy Dent is, and I'm trying to remember. Do you guys have anything for me?
I have no memory of that.
Harvey Dent was an orphan?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what the oh, so okay, wait a minute. It's in the Dark Knight book.
The book, not the movie. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know.
Okay. So. So you know, we were talking before about this guy as the Mad Hatter, right? You know, instead of him being the Joker as sort of the red-headed Mad Hatter, know that the sign on the Mad Hatter's hat is actually an abbreviation for LSD, right?
Right.
Yeah, pounds, shillings, pence or something like that, but it's actually right. LSD.
And then you have mercury, right? It's from mercury poisoning from the brims of hats, which is why he's the Mad Hatter. And then it's interesting to note that mercury was originally Tiferet on the tree, which is, you know, the point, the heart of the tree. So, okay. Go on.
Okay.
Okay. Harry Dent is fucking Two-Face.
Yeah. Harvey Dent is Two-Face.
What's Harry
Dent? Lucy Dent is Two-Face's mother.
Oh, yeah. Harvey Dent. Okay. Okay, cool.
And how does Harvey get half of his face disfigured?
Burned with acid. LSD.
With acid. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. And then.
But it's not a full transformation. It's like a half transformation. He didn't go fully into the acid.
Yeah.
It's like don't dip your toes. You got to dive right in if you're gonna dabble or something like. It's an incomplete kind of process.
Huh. Well, it's also, so you have Janus, right? The god Janus is represented as that. So, which is also money, right? There was this whole thing with Janus and money. I can't remember. There's coins. That's the whole thing is that it's, okay. So Harry gives his son Harvey a misprinted silver dollar coin with two faces or head sides. And so Harvey would consider it his lucky coin. That's just interesting because the fool with phallus is a Germanic word for these coins. So that was a connection between the Joker and money in the etymologically in the first place. That the word fool also comes from phallus as well as bellows to start a fire. So he burns the money, but then he also is money. So he's a sacrifice. Interesting.
And who is Charlie Brown's psychiatrist?
Lucy. That's right.
But he never touches Lucy. He only talks to Lucy. Every time he gets near to making any sort of contact with Lucy, she pulls the football away, which is the vesica pisces.
Right. Oh, wow.
He never goes through the gate.
He never splits it. So the vesica pisces is the split tree, right? Or the split Adam, right? Is the symbol of the two spheres, which is how you basically make the tree, is through the connection of two spheres, which the vesica is a symbol for the split. So that's weird. Okay, so there's a Monarch Theater somewhere in New York City. You should go check it out, Alan. It just came up in a suit. It was funny. I type in.
Should I ask my parents to come with me? Yeah, hey, Mom, Dad, I know you guys have been divorced for like 40 years, but you think you can come to the movies with me?
Well, Gotham City is another version of New York, right? If it's anywhere, it's supposed to be New York. And so it might be worth taking a trip out there. I was just looking at where it was, but I lost it. But anyways, I don't know. I was looking again at the character in Coraline, which is a fucking great movie. I love it. Her name is actually Miriam Forcible, which is funny because I was just thinking of when we were talking about the lion from the wolf, right? He's the wolf or he's the dog, and then he's the lion. That originally the strength card in tarot, which is the lion, was originally called La Force, right? So in the Marseille tarot deck.
Okay.
She happens to be named Miriam Forcible, opposite April Spink. April is obviously Aphrodite. So you have Venus and Aphrodite, and then she's obviously the pearl, which is the star of the sea. And it's interesting, just considering, I'm going to keep coming back in my head now, the Pearl Harbor as a symbolic representation of Miriam. So, anyway.
So, I want to just, this dog-cat thing, right? The wolf man is ruled by the moon, right? Mm-hmm. Its access point is controlled by the moon.
Right.
The vampire is ruled by the sun, in that it stays away. It can't be out in the sun.
Right.
Right. So now, who is ruled by the star? So what are human beings? We are civilized animals. We are dogs and cats. We are the domesticated chaos of nature.
Right.
Right? So, I mean, the moon is associated with the matriarchal age, which is the Isis, right? And then the Apophis is the sun, which is the patriarchal age. And then the dawning of the age of Horus is the child. Right, is the new aeon that Crowley said that we were entering into, and it seems to me that we are no longer ruled by the moon or the sun, because the sun we are ruled by the star. Well, correct.
That's the switch, right? So you have Sati, which belonged to the star, ended up getting incorporated with the emperor, right, which is the king. But what's interesting is if you look at the universe card, what does the woman hold in her hand in the Crowley deck but a giant fish hook, which it corresponds to Sati. So you have, and it's her lens to look through the eye, basically to peer the veil of the universe. She utilizes the fish hook. Now the fish hook belongs now to the emperor. In the Crowley deck, moved from the star, which the star seems to be a reference to Sirius. I thought that for years.
He even says it. He's explicit.
Does he say that in the Book of Thoth? I don't
remember. The silver star. It's the star Sirius. It's all there. I mean.
Right.
But this is, to
Wait makes the point that he says some people say it's Sirius. It isn't necessarily, but it doesn't really matter. If you read the pictorial key to Tarot, he says
well, wait.
He also makes a reference to Sirius.
The goal isn't to go. It's okay for me, and let history prove me wrong. But space travel, living on the moon, fuck that. I don't want my children or my children's children to have to live on the fucking moon. There are enough laws to life on Earth. You got to double or triple the amount of laws to have any kind of civilized society on the moon. I think one of the things in Prometheus that shows how human beings are human beings is that the two drugs that are represented on the spaceship and with the astronauts are nicotine and alcohol. And, you know, those aren't very enlightened substances. I think that was his little clue of saying, you know, the more things change, the more things stay the same. And it's drunkenness and poison that can bring you down. Now, I think that because there are so many laws associated with space travel and with living outside of the realm of the Earth, that how many laws are there in inner space?
Are you talking?
What's that?
No, I'm just was I going to ask for clarification? You keep saying laws. So you mean like natural law, like, you know, gravity or things like that? Or are we talking about man-made laws?
I'm talking about man-made laws. I'm talking about laws that, let's put it this way. It's like in Total Recall. You know, if you're going to live on a planet, you have to live in a dome. How do you ensure that someone doesn't go rogue and goes berserk and finds a way to take the whole thing down? A 9/11 event on the moon kills millions if you're going to have that many people living in some sort of contained environment, right? Think about how complicated laws are. Like my whole thing about if you were going to go on a ship and travel to the moon. Well, think of a terrorist event with a ship that goes to a moon. And if there's space stations. And do you think that how strict would the laws have to be? What kind of gates would you have to walk through so that no lunatic slips in and takes out a space station?
Well, I mean, for how many years did we live without all these massive restrictions on travel? I don't think... I don't know. You're going into a territory where your starting premise is something I don't agree with. So that's why I'm sort of trying to clarify before I'm following where you go from there.
How much freedom? You lose freedom if you live on the surface of the moon. There's no way you can say you have more freedom or the same amount of freedom if you live on the surface of the moon, because your environment is literally a cage.
Okay, so granted there are you know, obvious differences as far as atmosphere and things like that go. However, let's consider the progression of Europeans coming to North America and South America, obviously. Without even the history of, okay, there were already people living here and all that sort of stuff, there was, well, one of the biggest draws was the idea of getting away from the old system. And of course, that system followed them. The laws follow. But I always saw the idea of going out into space as just a continuation of that same exact thing. What would drive people into outer space would be the desire to get away from the laws and the monarchs and the oligarchs and the theocratic systems that are here. It's the same thing that would make someone go, you know what, I've never heard of what this other fucking land, but I'm going to get on a ship and I'm going to travel a possibly fatal journey to some land where I have no foundation, nothing, and it's going to be a hell of a lot of struggle, but I'm going to take my chances because I want to get the fuck away from this. And I always saw that that would be a similar thing that would encourage people to go out into space is, all right, if there's you want to call it a one-world government, you want to call it fascism, you want to call it corporatism, whatever you want to call it, basically the things that you're saying about these laws, if that doesn't appeal to you, where could you go that would be free of that? Yes, of course, you'd have to contend with your environment. Natural laws would still follow, and maybe those would be harsher, but the idea of, you know, going to outer space and you still have to answer to, you know, George Bush and Tony Blair makes no sense.
Well, I mean, I think that what we're experiencing is that continues the machine. It's to convince people that you're somehow liberated and enlightened in that, look at how great we are as a planet, because it's going to take a planetary effort to establish any kind of communities out on the moon and to have corresponding space stations.
Well, I don't understand why. I mean,
I don't really have, a 10-point thing to back it up, but it's just my feeling. I guess I kind of, and I'm not a fan of the show, I don't watch it, Star Trek, but I mean, it seems to me in the Star Trek universe, there's a pretty much united global understanding on planet Earth.
But think about that. So, I'm just saying, think this out for yourself. So, yeah, obviously, most media shows, the way we go into space, and because, of course, you have, 2010, where it's like, there's still Russian ships and American ships, but even 2010 ends with, like, hey, work together, we can all do this together type thing, and you can explore all these planets, just do it together, blah, blah, blah. And for the record, I'm not opposed to that. This isn't necessarily, an argument for or against globalism in that respect. I'm questioning why that automatically equates to global government.
There's all right, the idea. Well, supposedly Mars has like an atmosphere similar to Earth, and that, you know, it'll be very similar to what we're here now. It's just it's much bigger and more land and stuff. So, you know, we don't have to be in a giant glass capsule or in a spaceship. We could have land.
Well,
think of the golf courses, man.
Come on, you guys. We could totally live on Mars. It would be epic. We don't have to deal with corporatism or... Sorry.
No, I don't. I really don't understand where you're making an intellectual leap without even thinking about it. You're saying, on Star Trek, they have a federation of planets. Yeah, that's a fictional TV show. I'm talking about in real life, the way things play out, what is going to encourage someone? Let's look at our own space program here. So you have NASA. People were excited. Oh my God, yes, let's fight those communists and we're going to get to the moon first and blah, blah, blah. And then after a while, we go, okay, it's just a big fucking space rock. People are jaded and a lot of the people are not wanting to put a lot of funding behind NASA. And then what you do see is that there are these companies. Now, again, this leads to corporatism potentially when we talk about that. It's now corporate space programs, but things like SpaceX and all this sort of stuff. Again, these are not necessarily friendly companies. But my point is that here is a group that's a non-governmental group that's saying, well, we can go out into space and we can do this. So was it James Cameron is talking about investing in mining asteroids and stuff like that. This might be a corporate venture, would be the main interest, just like America started with, say, what was the, I can't think of the name, the tea company, the British tea, you know, like is the ones that are like going and they're going into India, they're going into China. So this is, merchants who are traveling at first. And then when they come back and say, hey, I went here and I already did this and it's safe and we've got a trade route down, and then people say, well, I can make that same trip, I think is a natural progression. It doesn't mean, yes, you're going to have the British are going to send their navy, and yes, the British merchants are going to send their ships. But then you also have people who perhaps either purchase a ride upon these ships or get together to commission ships, things like that. I think is the natural progression, and I don't think that I just think as a very objective look at history says that this is what people will do and will attempt to do, and that the idea of a clean, you know, this Star Trek idea of everything's like, oh, it's so orderly. Yeah, we got it all under control. You know, there's a Federation of Planets. Everyone on Earth is united. There's no fighting, and we all think that we should go out and explore together, and we all get the same uniform, and everything's hunky-dory, is a bit fascist and also a bit, I don't know, even though it's fascist, it's also optimistic in the sense that, yeah, everyone's just going to agree with each other, and it's a united planet. Seems to me it forgets the idea of individuals who want to go out and do these things as well.
Yeah, totally. See, we're going to have to slaughter all those moon men before we move in anywhere. See, that's the thing.
Would you rather have an educated nation of astronauts, or would you rather have an educated, and I hate the word, educated nation of psychonauts?
Is there a difference? Yeah.
Well, I mean, one takes traveling outside yourself literally.
No, right? That was a joke. I mean, it's actually not a joke. I guess my thing is, one of the things that I was comparing, the reason I'm comparing the, so we talked about Woodstock coinciding with the moon launch and all this sort of stuff. We talked about the atom bomb and LSD.
Perfect.
What I'm saying is, you have people who are going into outer space and you have other people who are going to inner space. They might not be the same group. So one group is very militaristic. They're going to get into like machines and they're going to launch themselves, and they have all these like very left brain mechanisms that they're going to use. And then you have this other group of people also emerging into the timeline at the same time who are taking very small substances, chemical substances, to bring themselves into their inner worlds. Like, when I'm saying, is there a difference? Yes, there's a difference, and yet there's also not. That we see
right,
that these
a,
things are parallel.
There's a distinction. There's a distinction, but there's not a separation.
Yeah. What did Kubrick say, though? What did Kubrick say when you got to the edges of your Beyond the Infinite? You got the same experience that you could have gotten sitting in your living room on Earth.
Yes. That's my point, yeah.
Okay, so why do we need these... To me, it's a call to return home. The Star Child says, I've taken this entire trip a million miles out into space to realize everything is at home. Now, the first initial journey is correct. You should do that. It's how you learn these lessons. But to not learn the lesson and to say, we need to continue moving out into space. We need to, I mean, to me, it's the wrong direction. It's a simple direction. It's a very linear direction, and it only has one outcome, is that someone will want total control of the operation, and out of that disagreement, you just get the dissonance and destruction that collapses towers throughout time. We always build up towers, and they always fall. And
So now let's back up here. So your idea of if we see the correlation between outer space and inner space, so obviously we started things like psychedelic research was started in very controlled systems, Harvard and Canada doing all these studies. And then at some point, Tim Leary gets on TV and says, this is the greatest fucking thing and everyone needs to take it. And it sort of spreads. And then you do have people who end up hurting themselves. You have, you do have crashes and burns, the same way you might have when you're trying to build a flying machine for the first time. You know, this wasn't a giant government operation. There were people all over trying to invent a flying machine. So if we take that same sort of idea, people are falling, people are getting hurt, some people are dying. Then you also do have someone wants to step in and control it. We do have evidence that the United States Army was trying to use LSD to control populaces. We have all sorts of studies. There's not just MKUltra, the idea they want to use it on opposing armies. They thought if they could put LSD into like a water supply, everyone would be too disoriented to respond, that they could invade a place after they fed everyone LSD. We have things where the army tried to give LSD to their own soldiers to see if they could be more susceptible to programming, and then it backfired on them, and they said a lot of the soldiers they gave the LSD to wanted to quit the army, that they no longer wanted to be part of the army.
Hell yeah.
But so I guess my thing is, you have the control system wants to dominate it. And then there's even things like people saying most of the LSD on the market right now is no longer what we would consider thumbs up LSD. A lot of it is stuff that has been tampered with by the government, just as they control, CIA controls a lot of the cocaine and things like that, that there's a control of the LSD market. Regardless, the control system wants to step in, but we would not see this as an ideal. When you're talking about inner space exploration, you don't want the government to come in and say, hey, listen, we need to be careful that when you can't just take LSD, because if you have this really fascinating thought, you might, you know, send a ripple across space-time and fuck something up. You might knock a tower down somewhere. So we need to control your LSD experience a la, you know, Total Recall or things like that. We need to give you a controlled experience. Hell, that's your movie theater experience, is a controlled hallucination.
Sure.
So they are trying to feed you a controlled experience. And then the natural instinct, though, that people everywhere, and I think all of us included, are experiencing is, fuck that. I want to go off the beaten path, and I want to explore something for myself. I might take some, you know, I might take some good notes. I might read a few books. I might, you know, ask some people who went before me. But ultimately, I want to try and do this for myself. The idea is to enlighten yourself, to free your mind, right? I think what we're trying to do is free our mind. So then why do we think when we take that the opposite way as far as space exploration or returning home, that we wouldn't want to be free people at the same time? Why do we want a fucking government system and all these laws to tell us how to live our lives if we don't want that same regulation of our inner space journeys?
Well, dude, would you want to live 20 leagues under the sea?
And would an you want to live garden?
In an octopus's garden? I mean, what's the difference between living on the moon and living 7 miles below sea level? Especially if you don't have the capabilities of returning.
Yeah, probably not that
There's
different.
There's no fucking difference. You're encased in enclosed environment that has to create its own oxygen, and you are subject to the dimensions of that enclosure. And, you know, you have outer space underwater. If the destination is a goal and you actually live somewhere and then you want to resume some sort of human kind of experience, then you're living in an enclosure. This all started for me is when I read Gurdjieff, and he said that, you know, all these different spheres have different amounts of laws that you can't transcend, you know. And he says the Earth has some 48 laws and the Moon 96. And I didn't understand that the first time I read it. But over time, I understood what he meant. And it's just that if you're going to walk outside, you take a walk outside on the moon, you're going to need a spacesuit. That's just a law. There's no way you're not going to
that's
be able
why
to
I
walk
asked,
out
that's
there.
That's why I asked
right?
if you're making a distinction between natural law and human-made law, because a natural law is, yeah, I need oxygen to breathe. So that's a natural law. But so that's why I was asking for that clarification. So there's a distinction between saying, hey, the environment's really fucking rough here or unpredictable or potentially fatal, and the distinction of, hey, we don't want a terrorist on the moon, so we better make sure that, you know, you're screened by Homeland Security first.
I think it's a combination of both. I think it's an amalgamation of more stricter sense of human laws in addition to the natural laws. It's just more laws everywhere, more rules everywhere you go. Recycling is not an option on the moon. Every single component would have to be subjected to a recycling program. So that if you just got lazy one day and said, fuck it, I'm not going to throw my beer can in the recycling machine, well, you would be fined for that. And everyone would agree. They say, listen, we only have so much aluminum. If you want beer, we need to recycle that aluminum. And granted, that's a very, you know, simple example and probably far-fetched. But you would have a law and you would have penalties because everyone would agree. There's no room for garbage on the moon, you know?
No. You're saying everyone would agree, I think, is a very short-sighted. You want to talk natural laws? I'll give you a natural law. The natural law is that not everyone agrees on a goddamn thing. You try and get people to fucking agree on something. I challenge you to get 12 of your closest friends to agree on, like, what bar to go to on a Saturday night. Succeed in that and just deal with that challenge, and then tell me you're going to take an entire moon colony and get everyone to agree that, yeah, you know what, we should be recycling cans. Good fucking luck, man. That's a natural law for you.
Well, I would disagree, because the moon people would be hip to them recycling laws.
We're going to have to slaughter those moon people before we move in. That's what I'm saying. Okay, you guys, I wanted to mention just a couple things here. Okay, so you got April Spink, which is Aphrodite, in Coraline, right? You know, at the end of the film, there's a scene where the dogs, which are shown in that film that we stopped to watch, there's the three dogs, which he was corresponding to the three stars of Sirius, right? The dogs actually turn into bats at the end, and the bats are actually what dissolve the two women, which is kind of crazy. Yeah, I believe there's three stars of Sirius, and there's Sirius A, Sirius B, and then there's a C. But so,
when did Sirius C enter into the picture?
I thought that there was a smaller part of Sirius.
There is. I'll be honest. I don't know if it's confirmed, but there is. This is a more, I don't know, like 70s, 80s type thing, where mathematically they're thinking there probably is a third star. You are correct. I've heard this a number of times.
I just wondered, did
the No God, I mean the Dogon tribe, were they aware of Sirius C, or did their visitors only tell them about Sirius A and Sirius B?
Well, them in the first
that
place.
That was the whole thing, is that the Dogon tribe.
Well, it's one guy who visited them that made those claims about the Dogon. The fact of the matter is that at this point, because of him, they're associated with that. And yes, it is possible, but at the same time, a lot of it is speculation.
Okay.
But anyways, it occurred to me, I was thinking, Red Knight, why am I associating Jim Carrey with the Red Knight? And it occurred to me, Cable Guy. Fucking Cable Guy, he goes to medieval times and goes, Red Knight's going down!
Oh, shit!
And so in Cable Guy, his, what's his name? Ferris Bueller. Fucking Ferris Bueller's name.
Matthew Broderick?
Yeah, so his address is 42, straight up. There's this lightning thing throughout it. He fucking, Jim Carrey falls on the big disc at the end, the satellite thing or whatever.
The bathtub.
And Matthew Broderick...
And it fills up with water, right? It's a bathtub.
Yes, totally.
And Matthew Broderick is also in Lady Hawk, which is the whole... We were talking before, I liked, Bill, when you said the idea that vampires are ruled by the sun and wolves are ruled by the moon. This is basically, even though in Lady Hawk, she's a hawk of the sun and he's the wolf of the moon, essentially the same thing, and Matthew Broderick is sort of their intermediary.
Oh.
Okay.
Weird.
He hangs out with the two of them, and since they can't communicate with each other, he relays communication between them. And
yeah.
What's interesting in that his name is the mouse. I don't know if that, you know, where you want to take a... Oh, it's actually the mice in Douglas Adams that come up with the 42...
They're pan-dimensional beings who are the most intelligent beings anywhere in all time or whatever.
Yeah, who can communicate between the sun and the moon? The super intelligent mice, right?
Right.
Well, Danger Mouse did Dark Knight of the Soul with David Lynch.
Oh, shit. Yeah, that's crazy.
it's a cat and mouse game.
Uh-huh, it's fucking Tom and Jerry. So, okay, Matthew Broderick is also, obviously, like I said, Ferris Bueller. But I had this whole thing where I was thinking of Ferris Bueller as the Ferris wheel And considering, well, first of all, Ben Stein is in that movie, famous for saying Bueller, Bueller, Bueller. And he happened to write the fucking John F. Kennedy speeches. He was John F. Kennedy's speechwriter as what? Well.
I know he was a Nixon speechwriter.
He was also Nixon's, but he did some speeches for JFK, I'm pretty sure. We should look it up to be positive. But I know he did Nixon for absolute, and I think he did JFK. Which is funny because you have these speechwriters who – you have these people who are supposed to be so diametrically opposed. And I know that he wrote for at least a few presidents that were – apparently diametrically opposed, yet they have the same speechwriters, which is very telling for anybody who wants to, you know, argue that these people are, you know, coming from completely different places when they're able to, you know, script it like that. But anyways, considering the Ferris wheel with Mighty Joe Young, who is the same people who did King Kong, which is our 11-11 climb to the top of the fucking phallus, sacrifice, king kill, everything, just on and on for days. This is their other film where he gets crushed by a giant Ferris wheel, which happens at Palisades Park. And I was considering, the guy who did the Gong Show where they introduced the woman is famous for doing the Spider-Man thing where she's like Spider-Man, Spider-Man, which is composed by the same guy who did Lolita, the soundtrack for Lolita. But anyways, it's just, I don't know. I was connecting dots there, but I thought it was just interesting. I don't know. Matthew Broderick is kind of a funny sync character.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the Ferris wheel, because this is the thing I'm having some difficulty explaining to people, is how the there's always what's known as the Catherine wheel is always present with the King Kill, and the fact that you have Mighty Joe Young crushed under the Ferris wheel is very telling. And that right. Ferris Bueller is there is, again, it's the same thing.
Well, the Wheel of Fortune, which is ruled by Jupiter, it is the Jupiter Major Arcana. And obviously Jupiter is the sacrifice of Saturn. Saturn eats Jupiter again and again and again until Jupiter finally is hidden by the mother and able to take over the pantheon and become Liam Neeson. But I don't know. It's interesting looking at it in that respect, especially considering that according to Carl Jung, the Jupiter center in the body is the solar plexus, which for me seems like when we hear this Jupiter is a second sun thing with 2010, the year we make contact, all of that business, which is 42, what's her name, the Helen Mirren, who also plays the Queen of Hearts. It says Queen of Hearts in the advertisements for the movie The Queen with Helen Mirren, who is also the voice of Deep Thought in Douglas Adams. But anyway, lost my train of thought. But, you know, 42, Jupiter, Wheel of Fortune, Ferris Wheel, crush the king with the Ferris Wheel. Just, yeah. Oh, also, so that was the thing is, okay, Donnie Darko, where does the thing come out of the chest that looks like the thing in Abyss, where you can basically predict people's movements and their futures? Because, so, occultly speaking, that center is said to be the seat of the instincts, right? So our solar plexus, in order to predict, but we will based on influence, so not free will, but us being influenced by various forces, that's actually the center. And so that's just an interesting connection there with the Wheel of Fortune, to think about it in those terms, because it also reminds me of, like, Da Vinci's man, the, like, archetypal man with his arms spread, you know? It's like that is his solar plexus. The center of us is our solar plexus. And to look at that, the Jupiter center, is kind of interesting in everything else that we've been looking at. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely.
Well, and also, I guess then you would have to have if the solar plexus is your center and that's your center of instinct, then you would want that vulnerable, correct? Like, I was thinking about how Batman's enemies, especially in The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises, the Joker, does he ever wear any armor?
I do not believe so. That's the thing, right. Batman's covered with armor.
It's that Reichian thing, right? Because that's, of his...
Something happens with Batman in the first one with his armor where they take off the armor. He gets, what is it? He gets hit or something, right? I'd have to look at it again, but I think he gets hit right in his solar plexus.
Okay.
And he fools them, and they think that he's been down, and then he leaps back up, does this whole thing. Joker's minions are with him, and something happens there. I can't remember what. I'd have to watch that movie again.
And Bane doesn't wear armor, but he has this, Dennis Hopper continuous drug system going on in his face, right? He doesn't have to wear armor because he doesn't feel pain because he's just sucking in morphine every minute of the day.
Have you seen the new Batman?
Yeah. I have. Have you? Hello.
I don't know what happened. We just lost David.
We lost David.
Can you hear me?
No, yeah. I couldn't. What'd you say? You said, did you see the new Batman?
Am I gone? Am I here?
You're here.
Okay, cool. So, no, I haven't seen the new Batman. I was saying I want to go see it tonight, maybe. I'll see if Amy's down. But I wanted to mention just really quickly just something that occurred to me in relationship to what we would say is the solar plexus or the Jupiter center relating to the Wheel of Fortune, is that they have this whole thing of that's the law of rotation, right, is when they correspond it Kabbalistically to the different laws. But these are laws not like a stop sign, but laws like gravity. But that center is our center of gravity. So thinking about it in terms of like, you know, the law, Book of the Law, you break it down, that's the core of that law, and that law is our relationship to the moon, right?
Crowley's
moon? No, I'm just saying, like, our relationship to the moon, that's gravity. I mean, how do we it's interesting because there's that parallel. I was just brainstorming and considering that idea of the law of gravity down to our center, and if that's the seat of the instincts, basically we're being influenced by a law. Okay. Is like, drumming? Okay. Yeah. We got a 10-minute warning just now, so we can wrap.
Maybe I'll address this because this is something I've been really working on, is that Batman has his armor, and that's what he wears due to his trauma, which created the Batman. For him to go into battle as an individual, he has the most advanced armoring, and in every one of his vehicles, it has the most advanced armoring, more advanced than even the military. This guy is fucking protected, right? But the Joker, he doesn't even know pain anymore. He's lived in pain for so long and for such an extended period of time that, you know, it's common to sort of see his aloofness in the face of chaos, and that he's just walking around with his makeup on, you know, with his fucked up makeup. And he could care less if he lives or dies on some manner. I mean, I guess the burning of the money is some sort of expression of that. He just doesn't give a fuck. So he's completely liberated from that protection, from that armoring. I was thinking about how James Holmes, when he walked in to the theater, I was talking to some army guys, and they were saying that, you know, he had neck protector, he had a groin protector. Like, this guy came strapped and ready to rock and was going to be able to take some bullets if someone came into his direction. So he was armored to the T. Now, I've heard many people say, you know, in offhand comments that if I was in that theater, I would have shot that motherfucker. Or I would have rushed the stage and I would have taken my knife and I would have stabbed him in the neck.
Live in Chicago.
And my whole thing is that if we're going to brand James Holmes psychotic, and it's very clear that to do that takes a certain break from reality, for someone to, in the theater, to attack or to run in where people run out, that takes a different kind of psychotic kind of mental status. And then someone said, yeah, unless you were trained to do that, meaning it would be psychotic for a civilian without training to do that. But if you were in the military and you were trained in how to deal with these situations, then you wouldn't be psychotic. You would just be trained. And then that sort of breaks down into, well, what does the military do? What does that training entail? There's a certain monarch programming in that they break you down completely and then rebuild you up into the standards and into the psychologies that are appropriate for going into battle. So I guess my question is to you guys, do you think that there's some substance to that? That anyone in that theater who would run towards James Holmes would be considered medically or clinically on some diagnosable level to be in a very small percentage of, and I hate to use the word, but psychotics. That it's a psychotic thing to do in a dark theater when someone starts shooting bullets at you to attempt to subdue him or to attack when everyone else is running or at least ducking for cover.
So again, you're saying you think it's psychotic to want to fight back?
Or to be able to remove yourself from instinct. And instinct is wired into us for millions and millions of years. That the fight or flight instinct. And that to feel fight in a situation where a guy has complete armor and firing a semiotic weapon when you have absolutely no armor, right? You're not Batman. You can't take on the Joker. Like, in this situation, the Joker has the armoring and the guns, and the Batman who would try to save everyone from the Joker in that movie theater would not have come to that theater in armor. That they would be completely vulnerable, and...
So, okay, all right. So, if I can address that, I mean, ultimately, I'm not one of those people who would say, if I were there, I would have fucked that guy up. You know, that's not...
That ain't me either.
It's not my instinct to say that. I don't have that kind of hubris. However, I think what you're asking is a very similar question that I hear in conspiracy circles. This idea of this, you know, vast elite that have all the resources, have all the weapons. If it's the military-industrial complex, they have all the armor and guns. If they, you know, if they're the banking system, they have all the money. They're the government, they have all the laws, all the police, everyone's on their side. If they have everything, how does one person stand up to that? And the idea that it would be psychotic to want to fight back or psychotic to fight back rubs me the wrong way. Even though I, like I said, it's, you know, on that very practical level, I understand how are you going to do this? Or I don't want to be this frat boy hubris of like, I would have fucked that guy up. No, I don't think it's that you can have that hubris to say, I would have fucked that guy up. But there is a bit of a survival instinct to say, well, here's the threat, so I can run from the threat, or I can eliminate the threat. You know, if it was a fire broke out in that movie theater, everyone would run out. If someone tried to put out the fire, is that hubris? Is that psychotic? Do you understand what I'm saying? So
I'm there with you. Yeah, absolutely. That's so the question.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question. I think that this is sort of, again, this is kind of the challenge we have, is how do we face what seem to be insurmountable odds, and is running, and this isn't like a criticism of those who would run away. I really want to make that clear. I don't mean that as a criticism. I just mean, at what point is running away not the option, or at what point is, you know, again, this is what potentially leads to a Batman, right? Batman says, they killed my parents, I have to fight back.
Well, it's that extreme trauma at a very, very young age that makes the Batman closer to the Joker than the civilians he protects.
Absolutely.
And that they both underwent extremely traumatic and mind-altering emotional upheavals that changed them into very, very specifically and a very, very extreme minority of kind of person. And my whole thing is trying to say that someone who would rush the stage, I'm not trying to condemn them as – it's unfortunate that the language sort of is limiting. Psychotic could possibly be a good thing if sublimated in the right way. I think that's what the whole Batman dilemma is Batman recognizes how psychotic his life is and how in his response to his childhood situation, I mean, he's on the wrong side of the law, right? He's a rogue. He's taking matters into his own hands. His fascist act of linking all the cell phones and, and eavesdropping in every conversation, people always stand up and say, well, that's wrong. That's clearly a psychotic thing. That's something the Bush administration would do. But, like I said, it's
hard. I mean, this is when we want to take it to the Bush administration. I mean, you see, like, I remember after 9/11, you know, a lot of people, of course, joined the military after that, thinking, hey, we were attacked and I want to defend my country. I want to do the right thing. Now, I don't believe in, you know, just going and randomly blowing up a country because we don't even have the full information of who did what. And yet there is something almost honorable about that instinct to say, hey, I'm going to put my life on the line to defend this or to you know, stop this. So I, as much as I understand that instinct, I think it can only be done with the proper information. And then this is where you get, so Batman doesn't just put on armor and fight everybody. He of course is the world's greatest detective, right? He's really figuring out what's what, or at least attempting to. And the only thing he can't seem to figure out is himself and his own role in this. You know, he can't seem to figure out that he's
damaged.
He's incredibly damaged. Yeah.
It's like the whole Sherlock Holmes thing is he's the greatest detective, but you know how they portray Sherlock Holmes with the Robert Downey Jr. is like a drug addict and kind of crazy. But that's because he lives in a world of paranoia, right? He sees reality from an ultra paranoid perspective. It's what makes him an incredible detective because he can see one event through 12 different possibilities. His genius is being able to center in on the one that's actually happening. But because of his paranoid lens, he's able to let in more information, more interpretations. And because he keeps his mind in that state, you see him always getting loaded to try to turn off that paranoid lens.
There's I'm looking at a graphic novel here that I would love to look at, which is Batman and Dracula. It's called Red Rain, just like red rum, right? You got your R&R, and it's Batman and Dracula. This looks cool, guys. Anyways, I think you were saying that we had 10 minutes, and I believe that was like 12 minutes ago. So did you need to go, Alan?
Yeah, I do. This is awesome as always, guys. Bill, I know you were really looking forward to today's talk. Did this meet your expectations?
Oh, no, absolutely. I'd like to get more into, well, actually, I'm going to refocus this whole psychotic argument and bring it back next week. But I mean, I appreciate any insight into it because for me, it seems like I've finally gotten some foundation with what Batman is, what it means to our country right now, how this shooting factors in. And I just really feel like for the first time, I'm really grasping a current event or a current event of this kind and really understanding, from my perspective, what it means, instead of being sort of a victim of the news and saying, well, what does it all mean? What do we do now? I don't feel like I'm lost here in this situation. And I just sort of credit these conversations to putting me in a position to understand it. So, yeah, I had a great time today.
Yeah, just to briefly say, I feel like if there is any sense to be made here, I don't want to associate myself with the guy who becomes a Joker to blow everything up, but perhaps that the other idea of the Joker we've spoken about, the idea of the Joker and the playing cards, where the Joker sits outside the game and watches it. You know, he's not putting on armor and shooting people. He's not a murderer. He's not a vigilante. He's sort of observing until, you know, and sort of watching the wheels go.
Well, Sherlock Holmes, not James Holmes. You can have a paranoia and you can have a cracked view of this whole thing, and you can allow yourselves to entertain all the conspiracies and all the occult information and all the insanity. But are you able to finally put your finger on something that is actually happening, and you can actually do something positive? Whereas James Holmes, obviously, he felt like he added up all the numbers. I'm sure he has knowledge of his father's situation. And for some reason, this, to him, I think, in the moment, made sense. He didn't know why he was buying all these guns and these ammo, but for some reason, in that moment, when he decided to go ballistic, it made some psychotic sense to him. And it's a tragedy.
It is. Oh, okay. Should I gotta go? But I want to leave you guys with a really sort of interesting thought. Have you seen the video of James Holmes giving a science presentation on how to alter people's perception of time?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, that's kind of really interesting, considering that we're in 2012, we have our whole, you know, time wave zero, and I mean, that is just one thing, but, and then as we were talking before about Steve Miller Band, fly like an eagle.
Time keeps on slipping into the future.
Indeed it does, and that's where I'm going with that. So, all right, maybe we'll pick it up there next week, see what happens. But that's time slipped away from us pretty fast today. This is already like 3.5 hours. So.
Really?
All right.
Well, guys, have a great night. Great day. I'll talk to you soon. All right.
Time keeps on slipping into the future. Slipping into the future. I wanna fly like an eagle to the sea. Fly like an eagle, let my spirit carry me. I want to fly like an eagle till I'm free. Slipping into the future. slipping into the future.